the scriptures are going to be read for us now. Liz is going to come and read the Bible. Thanks, Liz.
Our Bible reading today comes from Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1, starting at verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some Israelites from the royal family and nobility, young men without physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned to them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave to them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favour and compassion to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus.
How exciting, what a treat to be here, thank you so much. Do I need to, is it already fun? How exciting, thank you, thanks for having me, and I'm excited these next 2 weeks to be thinking about Daniel together. The first thing that you'll find out about Daniel, if you speak to anyone that knows anything about Daniel, is that it's written in 2 languages, one of the main books in the Bible that's done like that. So the first bit is in Hebrew, the kind of English of us, if your English is your main language, and then it switches to Aramaic. You see that in chapter 2, verse 4. Over the first bit, there's a footnote that actually it says there in Aramaic from now on. And this reminds me of a time I was in Japan visiting a friend, and we went to go to the cinema because we kind of got bored of each other's company. This person was out there doing a gap year, and I went out to go visit them. And in Japan, when you go to the cinema, so many Japanese people love English and want to learn English more that they keep the movies in the original American. And they put Japanese subtitles on the bottom so that they can keep their English going. And then you can also see the exact same movie at the exact same time in Japanese with Japanese voiceover. And we thought, great, we can go to the English one with the Japanese subtitles and just ignore the writing on the bottom. Except that we went to go see The Last Samurai, the Tom Cruise movie. It's pretty terrible. And the beginning and end of that has a kind of Japanese voiceover to give the kind of like, in the days of the samurai, there was this thing. But they did it in Japanese and had English subtitles. But because we're in Japan, they didn't bother putting them on. And at the end of the film as well, there's this kind of Japanese voiceover. In the days of the samurai, this one English guy with a ponytail and bad accent was this. And that was in Japanese as well with English subtitles, which they didn't bother putting on because we're in Japan. And so that movie, the beginning and the end, I have no idea what happens. And it's not a good enough movie to like bother watching again and see those little bits. So I still don't really know what happened. And it would have been like that for those in Babylon, that the beginning and the end was kind of didn't have the subtitles on. It was in Hebrew, so that for the Aramaic-speaking Babylonians, it would have been a mystery to them. And so this first bit, the Bible tells us, chapter 2, verse 4, that's when it starts being with the subtitles on. Before that, there's no subtitles. We don't have a clue what's going on unless you happen to be Jewish. So this is for the insiders, this bit here. And what it's going to tell us is that God is in control. That now we have the language skills, now we've flattened it all out by putting it all in English. This bit, just for the Jewish insiders, says, to those after the exile, once they've gone back to Jerusalem, to say, do you know what? Let me tell you, I was in control the whole time. Then in the local language, I'll tell you what happened in all the fun stories with the furnace and the lions. And then at the end, I'm going to tell you in your language again that I was in control the whole time. But it never looked like it in verse 1. Have a look, Daniel 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. So the king of Babylon comes and he does the old, you know, wait outside your house with a gun, turn off your water supply, steal your coals delivery, and then when your cupboard is empty, you've got to come outside and surrender. No mess, no fuss. Well, it looks like it's all Nebuchadnezzar, but verse 2, and the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. It was the Lord delivering, the Lord giving them over to their enemy. And now, when my best friend and I turned 18 in England, you get your driver's license and then you drive out to little country pubs. Well, we did anyway. And as we left, we kept a kind of, we swiped from the bar these little cloth beer mats of the local brewery. And we'd sort of say, oh, what's that over there? And nick one. And we kept them as little trophies for ourselves. We were so naughty. And then kept them all in a drawer. And then when I moved out of home, age 25, I opened that drawer and thought, what a loser I was. But that's what Nebuchadnezzar does here, is he kind of leaves this another city that he's taken over. He takes a beer mat. He swipes from the temple. After he's dominated a place, he steals a trophy, verse 2. These he carried off to the temple of his god in Babylonia and put the treasure house of his god. So why does the Lord allow, more than that, deliver his people into the hands of his enemy? Why are Israel's mascots now in the Babylonian trophy cabinet? Well, for that insight, we need the commentator of the time to give us some insight. And Jeremiah tells us exactly what went on. It's the joy of reading Daniel is so many other books kind of sew into it and make the Old Testament make a lot more sense. God here is sorting out his people into two bowls of figs. A good basket of figs sent to Babylon, protected for and cared for, and they will return to God with all their heart. And there's a bad basket of figs that will stay in Jerusalem under his curse because they didn't listen to him. And there's a great bit in Jeremiah 24. God says to Jeremiah, what did he see in that vision? And he says, figs. And that's what there was, figs. And sometimes I've done this. I've pitched the exile as God punishes his people by taking them away. But the Bible actually says, no, he punishes them by not taking them away. The bad figs are left behind. Just like when we go to the supermarket and we're in that fruit and veg aisle, we all become vegetable and fruit experts, feeling them up, touching them, working out whether this is a juicy one, a soft one, whether it's going to last 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. And we take the good ones away with us and leave the bad ones for someone else to pick over. Well, Nebuchadnezzar thinks this is the high point of his kingdom conquering. He's finally conquered Jerusalem through besieging it. And actually, it's God just doing his weekly grocery. He's taking the good figs off with him to Babylon. Someone else can have the bad figs and take those home another time. Someone else can pick over those. God is in total control, even as Nebuchadnezzar does his stuff. Hey, look, I'm not great with PowerPoint, so this is my PowerPoint. God is in control. God's in control. That's what's going on. God's in total control. And the rest of the chapter illustrates and demonstrates that. Because it's easy to say, yeah, I was in control the whole time as that massive calamity happened. But he needs to give some examples of exactly how that happened so that we can really, truly trust it and believe it. And the rest of the chapter focuses in on these four who were delivered over to Nebuchadnezzar to show, hey, look, I'm not just saying it after the event. We can all say that afterwards. You know, when someone's just broken up with someone, they've just been dumped, and they say, oh, it was mutual. You know, it was a mutual decision. Yeah, it was a mutual decision for them to dump you, is what it sounds like. It's easy to say afterwards that you're in total control, but here we're going to prove from the rest of the chapter, no, God really was. And what we're going to see is that in verses 3 to 7, God's in control even as they change their LLL. Even as there's a change to their LLL. Once the best of the temple has been taken to Temple to Babylon, verse 3, the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Ashpenaz is the foreign minister, and he holds the kind of Israel's Got Talent competition, and the winners get taken off to Babylon. These are the dukes and the earls, the Beasley Medal winners. Now, when the internet was new in the mid and late 90s, aged about 14, my best friend and I, the same one that we used to go off and swipe beer mats with, we went on a Christian dating site one night for a joke, and we had the best sign-in name of all time, of all Christian dating sites. Our sign-in name, no joke, was Fisher of Women. That is gold, isn't it? And but as we went through that site and had some nice chats with some people, we never ever saw a profile as bold as verse 4. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. That's quite a list. And Ashpenaz grabs this gang of Israel's finest, and his job then is to prep them with 3 years of training to then enter the king's service. And he does it in three ways. First, he changes their learning. He changes their learning in verse 4. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. So they're enrolled in Aramaic and taught about their many gods and the witchcraft that the magicians and enchanters used. Their learning would change as they know about the Mozart and Shakespeare of 600 BC. Alongside their changed learning, they would have had their longings changed as well. Their longings would change in verse 5. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. It's the absolute best. And by giving them the best food, they would be assimilated into Babylonian culture. And it would be softened and made more gentle by the fact they're getting the best food. In England, going to France isn't that big a deal. I'm from England. You know, I went on a day trip in year 6. It's really not that big a deal. So I went on a 6 week, when I was 13, a 6 week French exchange. It's actually a pretty miserable time. The only time I didn't really miss home was when the dad of this little French house I was staying in on my own for 6 weeks, took us out for mussels and chips on the Champs-Élysées right next to the Arc de Triomphe. And that amazing French cuisine made me not miss home anymore. Good food can change our longings and make us not wish we were somewhere else. And that's what happens here. But the biggest change isn't their learning or their longings. It comes in verse 6 as we change their labels. Their labels in verse 6. He changes their labels. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. You can't have your Hebrew labels anymore. Not when that so obviously keeps your head in Israel. You're in Babylon now. And you can't be in Babylon and still be Danny to the god of El. No, Daniel, you've got to belt to Shazar now. And you can't be Hanan to Aya anymore, or Mishing to El. You've got to Shadrach to Ach, and Mish to Ach now. And you can't go around Azariah-ing. No, you've got to Azar now, no longer to I. Instead, you've got to Abed to Nego. That's what you've got to do every time someone says your name. And this change of labels is wearing on the soul. We lie to our kids a lot, but there's no lie we tell our children more than sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. It's a whopper, isn't it, of a lie? And the names given to these four Jewish young boys were permanent and legal, and it would have worn them down. And with all these changes to their learning, to their longings, to their labels, God is still in control. And And it's interesting that the way that Babylon tried to culturally assimilate God's people into the culture around them, and it's worth wondering if the same cultural assimilation influences and stuff are on God's people today. Whether that's the way that empires change people in their hearts and minds to forget about their home and their God. So it's worth wondering whether we are having our learning changed as we're re-educated through our screens to believe that we are our own destiny, that we need to be our true selves and find ourselves. And our longings are changed constantly as our hearts long to live like kings in all we do and enjoy. That we're worth it. And our labels are changed as we're called fundamentalists or extremists rather than, you know, Christians. Or the labels of male and female, men and women, husband and wife, mother and father are under attack. The effect of the culture is everywhere, and billions of dollars a year are spent trying to change our learning and our longings and our labels. Daniel's cultural assimilation program is so similar to ours. It would have been, one of my favorite words, it would have been discombobulating for them. But the great news is for us is that, just like in Daniel's day, God is in control. Those 3 years for Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, as their longings and learnings and labels are changed, they could cling to one of the cheesiest Christian sayings, but I wonder if it's possibly helpful here. They wouldn't know what tomorrow brings, but they'd know who brings tomorrow. And that would help them, secondly, as they change some other stuff as well. As they change, I've got some S's for us. The first one is as they change to being a pest. They're an absolute pest, they are. As things happen to them, they responded just as we respond. They bemoaned the decline of Babylon as a Jewish country. Oh, our grandparents had it so much easier than us. It's such a nice Jewish place. They set up Jewish schools with closed enrollment to protect themselves from the Babylonian influences. They set up the BJL, the Babylonian Jewish Lobby, to change things slowly in Parliament. At every stage, they promised they would never go any further. But when the time came, they did. No. They got assimilated. They went along with it. They worked for the good of the city. They sought its peace and prosperity, as Jeremiah 29 and Tim Keller encouraged them to do so. But that wasn't the whole picture. It was neither isolation nor total assimilation. Because of that great word in verse 8, it often is a great word in the Bible. But. We pick up the story there. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, but he asked the chief official for permission. Nebuchadnezzar set names upon them, but Daniel sets upon himself to not do this thing. There's a line in the sand, a stake in the ground, a threshold that won't be crossed. And it seems strange. You're happy to sit there and lessons on witchcraft, but veganism, that's where I draw the line. And it's hard to know quite while he considers this defilement, something to chat about later. It could be the line in the sand is a religious one. He doesn't want to break the Levitical law. That's why it's the word defilement. Or it could be a political line. He doesn't want to get too close to the king and get too associated with him. Or it could just be a personal line, that he wants to have a line somewhere. Somewhere he can wake up and privately say, I'm not doing everything. I'm trusting God with this. I'm not sure we can tell. It doesn't give us enough detail. But he becomes a real pest for the royal official. And Daniel knows this, that he asked for the opposite of what we're told to do. He asked for permission rather than forgiveness in verse 8. And thankfully, we know that God is in control. As verse 9, God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. There's no other way this goes as the story does unless God was in control, both from the detail and then to moving empires around. He moves empires and he makes the re-education minister help this guy, his guy, stay off the meat and the merlot. He is in total and detailed control. And because of God's control, Daniel knows he doesn't have to isolate off nor totally assimilate. Daniel can learn and draw a line. He can make Babylon his home and still be holy. That's what it looks like to trust a God in control in a foreign world that is pressing down on us. And we'll be tempted to sway too far in one of those directions, depending on our personality, upbringing, or theological conviction. We'll either think Daniel went too far in being assimilated, that he should have put a stake down earlier, that he should have died rather than be in service to another king. And I find with my kids, I'm eager to train them not to listen to the world, to protect them, to ensure they don't learn or long or get labelled by the Babylonians of today. That's for my kids. Or it could be our knee-jerk reactions to think, oh, Daniel, just get on with the culture, mate. There's too much at stake to put a stake in the ground. You're just here to prosper the city. Never be protected from it. We're here to make this our home. So being holy, that's a private matter, just for you. We're to nestle, not wrestle. And I find while I want to protect my kids from Babylon, I'm happy on my own to sit in the Babylonian cinema and let the indoctrination and assimilation do its work on me. I call it, you know, it's contextualization, that's all it is. While Babylon sits and smiles and says, you Christians may call it contextualization, we call it progress. We're going to head in one of two directions over the top, but instead, like Daniel, I wonder if the model here is we have to be a pest. A polite, permission-asking pest. But a pest nonetheless. And the conversation from here in your pastoral groups can be, where's that line for us? Where's that line for our churches? And of course, Ashpenaz is now worried with this pest. He's in charge of breeding these stallions to go into the service of the king of Babylon. He can't have four of them looking like donkeys. And so his reaction is natural in verse 10. Why should he see you looking worse than the other men your age? The king would have my head because of you. He's saying, look, I know you won't eat dead meat, but I don't want to become dead meat. So Daniel goes from a pest, and secondly, Daniel says, look, can there be a test? Some of you are trying to work out what the other two are. It's exciting, isn't it? Huh? What a treat. Here, there's a test then. And so Daniel lays it down. Just give us our veggies and water then, verse 13. Compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the raw food. The test is agreed, and so while the others are enjoying surf and turf, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are just given the turf. I'm not sure about this joke, I tried it out on some people, only one person got it. They're going to eat Monge 2, but weren't going to Monge 2. I think you only get that if you know French. I won't use it again. And their hope was that they would live such good lives among the pagans that though they're accused of doing wrong, in the end, they'd glorify God. Amazingly then, verse 5, at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better than nourished than any of the young men who ate the raw food. They were afraid of them looking like donkeys compared to the stallions. Instead, they're the most thoroughbred of them all. And so from then on, the guard gave them their vegetables instead, verse 16. God loves an unlikely win. Abraham only has kids in his old age. Jacob was the younger of the two. Gideon only gets an army of 300. David goes against Goliath. Jesus rises from the dead. And the danger here is it won't be an unlikely one. These are the best four that Israel has got. And so to make sure it's an unlikely victory, they come in weak but end up stronger than everyone. So that we know that even though they're in Babylon, away from home, away from Jerusalem, away from the temple, he still protects his chosen ones. They're given new names. They give themselves to be defiled. But the real win is, most importantly, is what God gives them. To these four young men, God gave knowledge, verse 17, an understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. So because God is in control, they can be a pest. And they're put to the test, but they come out best. Even the king sees it when the chief official finally parades them in front of the finale of Babylon's Got Talent. And the king, verse 19, talked with them and he found none equal to them. So they entered the king's service. And the king then finds them, verse 20, 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. Ha, can't believe that, can you? That's what chapter 2 is going to prove. And so they served at the trickiest one, at the behest of the king. And so for the Hebrews reading this bit without the subtitles, it's a message to God's people that even though you're foreigners and aliens, living among the pagans, abstain. Don't defile yourselves. Shine like stars no matter what the darkness around you is like. Now this isn't the end of the book. It wasn't all dreams and easy. We know what happens. For these four young men, it wasn't all a nice holiday to the Middle East. It was furnaces and lions and death threats, and bow down or you're for it, as they lived as prisoners of war in the control of a dreamy dictator who was always on an emotional roller coaster. But God is in control. Even as they had their learning language and learning longings and labels changed, and even as they changed from a pest to a test to the best of them, to serve at the behest of the king, as it all changed, God was in control. And the dangerous will think, of course, when the time comes, I'll stick my neck out. I've got my stake ready right here to put in the ground when the time comes. I'll enter the furnace. I'll pet the lions. I won't bow down. I won't eat meat when the day arrives. There's extraordinary days when I'll make my stand and then I'll know that God is in control. But there's something in the last verse that makes us wonder if the message is more than that. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Reading the whole of Daniel, we think he had a life of extraordinary events and feats. But there's less than 10 days or events or moments in his life worth mentioning. There's only 10 in the book, less than 10 I think, of extraordinary courage, of stakes in the ground, of the line in the sand type boldness. And we think, that's what I'll do. I'll stand up then. I'll stand my ground. I'll be bold then. But verse 21, it was 50 years. He was there for a lifetime. It was 50 years until Cyrus comes and changes the world scene and the Persians take over. Less than 10 events, 8 or 9 maybe, days in Daniel's life worth writing down, where he saw God at work very clearly. That means that he was there for... I used to be a maths teacher, that's why you can't read my handwriting, that's why I love numbers. He was there for that many days, we know, and for that many of them, nothing was worth noting down. That means that out of 18,250, there were just 10 that he wrote down. The other 18,240 were very ordinary. Ordinary days. Lots of days and lots of data. Of just humbly doing what God wants. Sure, he stood up. Sure, they didn't bow down. Sure, they put their stake in the ground when the time came. But for most of it, they just did what God wanted in a world that hated them. And that's how Daniel 1 ends. And that's where our story begins. I'll pray. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the ultimate Daniel Jesus. He comes and stands against all tests, and in the end is consumed by the world to die for the world, to save the world. Thank you that in the most unlikely victory of all, his rising from the dead, we can be bold when the world seems against us, knowing that you always, always bring us home. And as we look at the amazing events of Daniel's life, help us to see the faithfulness to them in the everyday, that we may do the same. Amen.